Good afternoon, listeners. We're going to invite you today to imagine a world in which you step into and your past seems something out of a dream, and the present is full of possibilities. And your future is open to as many things as you can imagine. So what we're talking about today is this incredible experience known as Burning Man. And so I want to welcome you to this episode of This Anthropological Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And this is Anil Tripathi.
This is Ryan Collins.
And we're joined in studio by our favorite returning guest, Ben Gibo. He just came back from Burning Man, actually. So welcome to the program, Ben. Welcome back to this side of the world.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be back. I think this is my third time here.
Third time, right?
Wow. Well,
many more.
Yeah. Third time's the charm.
Third time's the charm. Well, you know, thank you so much for having me here. I'm happy to be a guest on this show again. I'm happy to talk about my experience at the Burn.
Cool. It's a pleasure to have you. And so I think today we can kind of kick it off by talking a little bit about what Burning Man is. I mean, I think some people may have heard of it. But, you know, so, you know, Ben, you just came back from an experience there and had a wonderful week. And I just want to talk a little bit about sort of what Burning Man is that you understand it. You know, again, the theme of today is kind of thinking about notions of culture in the making, right? And how do we make new sort of social worlds? How do we think about how we connect with one another, kind of theming off of an episode we had a couple weeks ago? So maybe a little bit about just kind of kicking off what Burning Man is sort of meant to you. You know, what was it? What kind of an event was it? You know, was it a campground? Was it a carnival? What sort of things can we link it to that if we've never heard of it or never been to it, what kind of things like that make you
exactly.
Make think of it?
And what exactly is the Burning Man?
Well, those are all good questions. And, since it was my first burn, hopefully I can do my best to explain it in the quickest, most simple way possible. But so I had a lot of friends who have been seasoned veterans at Burning Man, and they've told me all the things I need to do, what to pack, how to prepare, the outfits I should bring, and sort of just generally what to expect. And they all did a great job. They gave really good insight, and it was everything that they told me about, and then so much more I didn't even anticipate. But in a nutshell, you know, what is Burning Man? To me, at the end of the week, I tried to figure out exactly what it, you know, the best way to describe it. And it was a lot of different things. It was part video game, part Mad Max, part Never Neverland, part alternate 1985 from Back to the Future 2, part psychedelic dream rodeo dance party filled with weirdos, me being one of them, and everyone's a weirdo there, all with like a choose your own adventure sort of theme. And it sounds great. It sounds like a utopia, but it is definitely not a utopia. It's almost, in a way, it's an emulation of real life, but with a world that, you know, we wanted to create by ourselves, I guess.
So in some ways it kind of points to that we're going for social systems here, right? We're trying to build a sort of a new kind of sociality, but the rules can be changed and bent and made in new ways, right? In ways that perhaps we may not see as commonly, you know, on the streets of Reno, maybe Reno, but, you know, maybe not as commonly somewhere else in Boston, Massachusetts or you know, Milwaukee or something, right?
Sure.
Now what, so one thing that fascinates me about Burning Man is also all the dialogue that goes on past Burning Man, right, or before it. So what were you told really, you know, in preparation for what to expect by your friends? And also, actually, you know, what did you have to buy to go to Burning Man? Or what was everything that you brought beforehand?
Well, let's see. So my friends, essentially the main thing is bring water. That's number one. Bring all your own water. Bring more than you need. And we had plenty left over, and we were able to give it away to other people, and which was nice. Bring all your own food. Although you could probably get away with just not bringing any food and just relying on other people for it, because everything there is sort of gift based. So everyone just gives away everything. It's not as if the ticket itself allows. It's not like the ticket to Burning Man pays for all your food. The ticket allows you to go to a place where everyone is giving things away to people. And it's not, and that's the other thing, is like the idea of it is that you don't just go there and everything's free. It's like you're a participant as well. You know, you're a citizen of this city, and you have to, you know, you can't just take. If everyone takes, nobody has anything, and things will dwindle pretty quickly. But you have to have something to offer. And it's extreme survival. The days are really hot. Around 8:30, 9 in the morning, or is when the sun comes up, and you know, if you had a long night, you're going to wake up because of the sun. You're just going to start sweating immediately. Mm. Although the camp that I was in, we had a pretty good setup. I was with this camp called Altitude Lounge, and, you know, they've been there for a long time, and they're some of the most amazing people I've ever met. So inclusive and friendly and just really cool people you could have really down, you know, down to earth conversations with. And yeah, so the thing with Burning Man is like, yeah, you got to be prepared. You got to bring all your own stuff. You got to, you know, prepare for the weather, prepare for the heat. And at night it gets cold. It gets down to like the low 40s, high 30s. You got to, there are just random dust storms that happen and you can only see 3 feet in front of you. So you have to get goggles and get a mask. And being a photographer, I completely decked out my camera with, you know, with tape and Ziploc bags just to make sure it was completely playa proof. And it worked well. There was no dust to get in there, but it was very difficult to maneuver. So I might have to do something about that next time. But let's see. There's also it's the biggest Leave No Trace event in the world. Mm. With 70,000 people, it's amazing that a city can just pop up and there for a week and then it's just gone. You know, and they value civil society and the idea of community, radical self-expression, and radical inclusion. So if you're there, you're a part of it. You can just walk up to anybody, give them a hug, you know, and some guy will walk by you and be like, hey, you want a drink? I'm like, all right, thanks. And, you know, I had some really deep, meaningful conversations with strangers while we watched the sunrise. And then it's like, all right, I'm off. I'll see you. And then you wow. never see him again, you know?
Now, one thing that really struck me about what you were saying is how you said that when you, the ticket that you buy to Burning Man, right, is a ticket that allows you to go to a place where all this happens. And Place has some interesting research in anthropology. You have Wisdom Sits in Places by Keith Basso, which actually talks about how the Apaches kind of visualize space and conceptualize places that then teach them moral stories in their environment. So what do you think, what are the places at Burning Man? I mean, you said you were at Altitude Camp, right? Are there...
Altitude Lounge.
So are there lots of very noticeable differences between the camps at Burning Man, or are there lots of particular places within
the location? Absolutely. You know, sort of every, at least my understanding of it is that, we'll keep in mind, since it was my first time, I was just wanderlust, like exploring, just everything was new. It was a culture shock in the best way. And so I try to absorb as much as I can, but it's like trying to cram like 10 pounds of water inside like a water bottle or something. You can't quite do it. And there was so much I missed out on, but still so much that I saw. And you can find a map of how it's laid out online. It's sort of like a circle, but sort of a semicircle, and there are different grids. And it's really easy to get around when you look at it. But when it's at night and there are lights everywhere and there are sounds everywhere and you don't know where you're going, you're just wandering off. But that's the best part about it, is because you sort of choose your own adventure. But yeah, every camp sort of had a different theme. Our camp, I guess the theme is just, you know, we had this 5-story scaffolding tower that was just covered in lights. We had the brightest light on the playa, and it was sort of a beacon for us. So when you're at night and you're just not really in the right state of mind, trying to find your way home, and you look in the horizon and you say, okay, there's the tower, and you just head to the tower. You get on your bike through the sand and keep on biking, and you're like, oh, there it is, and keep on biking, and it's still far away, and eventually you get there in like half an hour. But so our camp was sort of, it's like a lounge. It's a chill hangout spot. If you just want to go there, chill out in a hammock. We have a bunch of couches and stuff on the tower. My friend Dan and his wife Arielle, they got married up there this past Burning Man, and that was amazing. We had 40 of us up in the tower. Everyone was dressed in white, and we had these prayer flags, and it was beautiful. And we had an art car. It was called the Pliopus. It was this fish that had this winding tail that was made out of 2-liter bottles, and it was amazing. And everyone just, like, there's a camp that all they do is they serve pancakes and PBR. And then there's another camp where all they do is just give really enlightening lectures the whole time. And every camp has something that they offer. one of the camps next to us where they just gave away tutus to everybody. Another one was just a cafe where they gave away tea and croissants, like, all day, every day. And it's just everybody, like, it's like once you give and you see how happy people are, it's you just want to give more. And everybody kind of gets on that same mentality. And everyone's just giving everything to everybody, and it's fun, and it's just it's a beautiful experience.
Hmm. You know, it's a lot of cool stuff you just said there, Ben, that I want to dive into. And one of the things that really strikes me is you mentioned before this kind of notion of kinship that comes up in Burning Man, and like how people learn to become related to one another, and like in different ways. And you said there's just strangers you could walk up and talk to and have these conversations that'd be ephemeral, right? You'd show up and say hello at sunset, talk about that, and then disappear. But what's really interesting is that, like you said, 70,000 people attended this year, which is incredible.
70,000.
This is the 28th year of Burning Man. So it's a fairly new sort of tradition. In the original year, 1986, there was 20 people that went to Burning Man. So the idea that there are now, in fact, different camps with different kinds of people that just serve pancakes, you know, that have this kind of like this activity or whatever, like it's really incredible to think about how this community has grown, right? And how people learn to come in contact, you know, the notion that people may use message boards throughout the year to keep in contact with their different constituencies that they may live with, you know, and they want to go back. And Ben, even you mentioned before the show, even talking about that some people, like, this is what they do. Burning Man is their thing, right? Uh-huh. That they work throughout the year, they do their own thing, and then they prepare for Burning Man. And that's kind of like one of their main sticks. And so, like, it has this incredible power to draw people in, right? And just to think about, right, again, 28 years from 20 people to 70,000. Pretty incredible, right? So even that idea, in terms of that, you can see there's something about it, and I think you're hitting on one of those notions of the sharing economy, or the gifting economy, we can call it, right? The idea is, like, once people start giving and realizing that there's not this, this is what this is about. It's not about this, like, oh, if you give, someone's just going to take. It's like, but everybody wants to give, right? And that even harkens back, we mentioned a few times, to Jeremy Rifkin's notion of that people want to belong in community, right? That's mm-hmm. one of the things that we're kind of wired to do as people. And so, like, we make kinship in these really cool ways, and Burning Man's this great social experiment, but also this alternative social world, right? And that's kind of what we're thinking about with it, is that, like, it's not just this thing out there, but there's something really about it that, again, that we're seeing it grow in 28 years, this massively expanding.
It's really interesting to tag onto that idea and to think about how human societies have even evolved in the first place, because we have this setting where people are making a sort of pilgrimage out to this site, and it grows year after year after year, and now we're seeing that people are bringing their specialties to the table in different ways. Mm. So you're starting to see that, you know, people are taking on certain roles, they're producing certain products and exchanging them for other products, and you never know what type of way that will fully develop. But this really signifies a lot of what we see in the ancient past, a lot of sites that we see even out west in Chaco Canyon. In fact, the map of Burning Man really looks like one of these sites out there. On top of that, you've got the one of the Burning Man towers where the effigy is, and it looks like a pyramid. It recalls these ancient ideas mm-hmm. of unifying people for certain events and bringing together to imbibe and whatever sort of things that they can bring, and then you disperse.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point, Ryan. It makes me think of that Burning Man mixes together the ancient world and the distant future, right? And even the pictures, if you look at any photographs, type Burning Man, there's really fascinating, as you said, the carfish?
The Pliopus.
The Pliopus, you know.
Which, like, is one of hundreds of art cars that are there, by the way.
And so, I mean, we call them art cars, but at the same time, it does seem reminiscent, you said, of Mad Max, this apocalyptic future of living in the desert, wearing these different kind of costumes, and, you know, mm-hmm. and that's your tribe. So again, like, it does this really interesting mixing of temporality of this sort of the ancient world, you know, and the future, but that is actually eminently the present.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, you want to talk about the present. You know, one thing when you're there, it's like, so essentially when you get there, so Gerlach or Gerlach, I'm not exactly how it's pronounced, but that's the last town before you get into Black Rock City. And it's maybe a 3.5-hour drive from Reno to Black Rock City. And then it's, depending on what time you arrive, you know, you can wait 20 hours in line, and that's its own kind of pilgrimage mm-hmm. in a way.
Right.
We were lucky to we got in at the right time. We had no line, nothing. We just went right in, you know, rang the gong, did my dust angel, and, you know, I was in. I felt like I was home. And at that point, looked at my cell phone, no service, threw it in the glove box, said, that's it. You know, no cell phone, no wallet, no money, no watch, no mirror. So they give you this book of what, where, when you first arrive. And a lot of the season burners, they don't really follow it so long. But there's a lot of really cool stuff that you can just, you know, that you really want to, if you really want to check out, you know, you got to keep track of it. But I didn't bring a watch. So I would have to ask people, like, what time it was and stuff, which was fine because it allowed me to just have conversations with strangers. But I remember the first time I was like, oh, I want to go check out this really cool talk. And I asked this guy, I was like, hey, man, you have the time? And he was like, I got the time. And he showed me his watch. And on his watch, it just said now. I was like, yeah. It's like, you're right, man.
Did you make it to the lecture?
No, I went to go to this place called District and dance for a few hours.
Not a bad thing. It's actually, I'm glad you said that the word pilgrimage too. This is you know, there's again a lot of literature in the anthropology about that too. And mm-hmm. thinking of Victor Turner's notions of pilgrimage, and one of the things that he talks about is he focuses on this liminal space, right? And so it's like there's sort of the first phase that you sort of move into this new space. You're going on this pilgrimage to then become transformed. And then this is what's known as like separation from society. So you're literally severing your ties, putting your phone in the glove box, putting the watch in the glove box, leaving these things, even your identification behind. You're relinquishing your identity to then build a new one, which is this liminal phase in which the rules that are followed normally in life don't apply. Right. I mean, of course, there's some like be nice to people, but in general, like the rules that you walk by, what you wear, how you interact with people, how you obtain things and give things, like these are different. They're in differently, you know, known in the, again, your identity is in flux too, because you are who you are. But again, nobody knows that, right? Again, who you can make yourself in this way. And of course, after that is the reintegration phase when you come out of this liminal phase. But let's for now, since we're here, let's focus on this liminal phase. Like in Burning Man is this sort of this middle space in the pilgrimage, in which the rules are upended, right? And you said that, I love the idea of the watch just being now, right? And one of the hallmarks of sort of the liminal phase is this enduring present. Right, there's no past, there's no future yet. Right, right now you're only here.
It's the only thing that's real.
It's the only thing that's real, right? And there's something about this, something compelling. I mean, I'd love to hear thoughts about that too. And just like that, is there, you know, what for you in terms of temporalities? Right, obviously there was no the watch. The now thing is a great example, but like, so for you, what was your kind of thoughts? Did the past and the future sort of disappear? Were you thinking about them all the time? Like, what was kind of your emotional state going through this week? You know, so you're in this liminal phase for about a week, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, let's talk. I'd like to hear some sort of about your emotional roller coaster and, like, what was it like to feel in this liminal space? Like, you're there on purpose, which is really interesting, too, you know. And, you know, so what were some of your expectations kind of going into this? And, like, sort of how did they sort of fill out when you were there?
Well, I mean, that's a big question.
Yeah.
It's a big question. I'll try to do my best to answer. So just as far as the pilgrimage out there, and the thing is, this isn't just a festival. This isn't like a music festival, although I guess how it's been described, it's a little bit more music based now than it has been since its inception. But it's still, you know, really about the other, you know, values that I mentioned before. But getting a ticket to Burning Man is probably the most difficult thing about Burning Man. It's more difficult than actually, getting all the food you need and getting, you know, all the stuff prepared. It's really difficult. So it really separates the people that are all about the burn as opposed to people that just want to go party in the desert. So that's one thing. And the pilgrimage getting out there, people come from all over the world. I met this guy from Cuba and he like, it was, there were so many different people that you meet from all over the place that are, and you realize we're all on the same page. So the pilgrimage out there, it's like, you got to get a ticket, you got to fly out there. I was actually out there all month. I was in the West Coast all month, just for various things, like doing some projects, my friend's wedding, and did a lot of biking and running and stuff like that. And I decided to end the month off with Burning Man. And so, getting out there is not easy. You get your car, all your food, you get your tent, you get everything. You know you're going to forget something. But you get there, meet up with your camp. Generally, you wait in line for a long time. And it's really not fun. Obviously, waiting in line is never fun. But that's part of the beauty of it, is that once you finally get inside, you're like, we went through the hell. We're finally here. We're all here together. Mm-hmm. We all shared our stories. There were people that were... So there was a thing where they shut down Burning Man for about a day because there were crazy rainstorms. And, you know, Black Rock City is essentially used to be just a lake bed. And when it rains, everything turns to clay. So people that were like, once they stopped letting people in at the gate, they couldn't go back because they stopped letting people. So they were in this weird purgatory. It was like this Burning Man purgatory, but everyone that was there, nobody complained. They just said, all right, let's just party out here. And people, you know, busted out, whatever, you know, their music and their R cars going and stuff like that. And they just kind of just chilled and drank and had a great time until they opened the gates again. And, you know, it was a little, pain in the neck, but once you get in there, it's you essentially, like after the first day, once I met everybody and kind of get acclimated, and my phone was away and no money, nothing like that. And I put on my costume, which was essentially a reversible vest with like, I had a sash and I had, you know, a bunch of bandanas, and it was very practical, but also kind of groovy at the same time. And, but once I was there after the first or second day, I almost felt as if my life was just sort of this preloaded false memory or this dream that didn't really exist. Because like if somebody wanted to reach out to me for whatever reason, they can't. This is my home now, you know?
Yeah.
And there wasn't any time. It was literally it's bright out or it's dark. That's it. And it felt like it lasted 2 days, but it also felt like it lasted forever. And then the reintegration into society was pretty weird, to say the least.
I think the entering Burning Man is such an important thing to analyze, right? Because that's one of the big characteristics of liminal space. There's usually some exclusivity, right? There's you can't just let everyone in. You know, you have a very kind of guarded,
yeah,
right? So what was the whole process of getting the ticket, actually? Or what made that such a complicated...
I kind of screwed up when I went to go get my ticket. My friend, who's a seasoned burner, ended up grabbing mine because he realized I didn't do the right protocol. It's something where you have to sign up for, you know, on the Burning Man website, and then you have to do a special sign up just for ticket purchases. And then there was like this whole process, and you had to get in queue online like right at this very specific time. And I totally botched it. And I told my friend Dan, I was like, listen, man, I don't think I did it right. And he was like, ah, I was like, all right, I'll try to take care of it. And lucky enough, he was able to get 3 tickets for him, myself, and then my friend Greg, who also came. So it's not like going online and just getting a ticket for, you know, to see a band or whatever. It's a lot more involved, and they almost make it difficult purposely, yeah, just to kind of weed out, you know, the people that are there for a good time.
It seems almost kind of like a bureaucratic authority. Right, because there's no one, you're not being interviewed directly, right? But then there's this online queuing, right? Yes. And this, so it seems, you know, that's how it seems to be limited, right? It's
exactly
the bureaucratic order.
Yep. So hopefully I learned, and next time I'll try to be, I'll hopefully I'll know what to do next time.
Well, it's one of those things. I mean, one of the things that strikes me too is that there's an interesting article on Slate. It was by Seth Stevenson, and is this notion of like, there's a couple things that he writes about the Burning Man experience. And so you haven't read the article, which is important because we want to know your reactions to sort of how this is spoken about, right? And kind of one of the things is that like the notion of the gifting economy was really a thing that really drew this person in when they're thinking about Burning Man, right? The fact that you just give and people want to give. Mm-hmm. However, then he had this really interesting quote that he says that I'm not really sure how much relevance it has to real life. And that's a very striking quote. That this person has said, and you know, I'm not going to make the claim either way because I've not been to Burning Man, but you know, I mean, I would of course lean on
the side. Has the guy been to Burning Man?
The guy had been to Burning Man, yeah.
Okay.
And so it's one of the questions. I'm curious, like your thoughts about why somebody would say that, like this relationship to real life versus Burning Man, as if it's somehow different, or is it different?
You know? Well, I will say this: that Burning Man happens 1 week a year for a reason, because it's not exactly sustainable for what it is. But it is for a week, you know, and if it can work for a week, why couldn't it work for 2 weeks or a month or a year, you know? Mm-hmm. And like I said before, it's certainly not a utopia. And there are a lot of things in life that are sort of mimicked in Burning Man, which I guess is just natural, because if you want to look how do you get a system to work, you just look at what works already and just try to emulate that, right? So what was his quote again?
He said that the gifting economy was he really enjoyed it, in which people, he said, you know, people work together to feed, shelter, and amuse each other without requiring compensation. However, he says, I'm not sure, you know, how much relevance it has in real life.
Well, I think the problem we have in real life is that there are just too many people. I think that might be one of the issues. And the fact that there are, I mean, 70,000 people is a lot of people.
A lot of people.
That's a lot of people in one place. But sort of like Burning Man was created, you know, what do you say, 28 years ago?
28 years ago, yeah.
And so it's so new that people are making up the rules as they go along, where you look at all civilizations throughout the world, you know, it's been such a slow process, so everyone has their different rules, and we're all just trying to work together, and, you know, religion and all these different things are just combative, where in Burning Man, it's like, let's all just agree that, you know, we're living in a desert for a week. We got to be prepared. Let's help each other out. People are going to get freaked out. You know, people are going to be better at this than others. People are going to be worse off at this than others. Some people are really good cooks. Some people are, you know, really good at like building things. And everyone can bring their own specialty to the table, you know, and that's sort of what it's all about.
Now, there have been some things though that have kind of seeped into Burning Man, right, from the outside world, right, such as, you know, even kind of socioeconomic hierarchies. There was an article that came out, right, about Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, all these tech tycoons who have all been to Burning Man and, you know, put on these extravagant displays, create up their own camps where it's $25,000 per person to right. join. So did you see any of this at Burning Man or?
Well, let me tell you, you know, I try to do my best to, you know, go in groups of people and try to explore specific things. But when I was there, it's just, it's so overwhelming that you're not even aware of what's going on. You don't even know what. The third day, I forgot who I was. I didn't know who I was. I was just trying to figure that out. And then I said, I can't really answer that right now. So I'm just going to move on. And, you know, it's like once you're there, you know, it goes back to the radical inclusiveness thing. It's when you're there, you're a part of Black Rock City. You know, you are, you know, a burner. And the only thing that I remember seeing that sort of had any kind of, you know, super rich elite kind of aspect of it was there was this huge yacht that I think they just put a truck underneath and they put these like blue lights on and they just had it rolling around the desert with a bunch of people that didn't have any playa dust on them at all. And I kind of saw that. I didn't really think anything of it because there were so many art cars and so many things to see and do. I just, it didn't really compute. And once I left, I knew, you know, you guys invited me on the show and I decided, I was like, well, I'm not going to read any articles because I want to have all my memories fresh and, you know, completely my own subjective view and bring that to the table as opposed to reading other articles that influence my opinion.
Right. No, it's really interesting to think about this where, you know, Anil brings up, you have these CEO type of elite people who have lots of money going out there to these events. But you're also saying that maybe that doesn't matter. That there's sort of like a contradiction that can't happen in real life, that in this sense they can actually be there and be participants of the burn, and that's enough for that.
Sure. I think it was the second to last night that I was there, and so we can talk about what the man means and like the burning of that, but they also have this thing called the temple, which is a place where people bring, it's essentially just a place where you can remember loved ones, and people bring pictures and different mementos, and they write little stories about people that they've lost. You know, everybody. It doesn't even have to be somebody that you met. You know, people had stuff with Robin Williams up there, and thank you for the laughs and all that. And it was one of the most emotionally draining things I've ever witnessed, because I've only heard a little bit about it. It's like, oh, this place where you kind of go and, you know, show, you know, appreciation for the people that were in your lives and that sort of thing. That's kind of all I was told about it. But I made an effort to not know anymore and just try to experience it on my own. And so I went there, and it was the most beautiful structure I've ever, you know, seen that was built in such a short amount of time. They built it in 3 months. And everything was made out of wood. It was super ornate, and it was just this beautiful structure. And I'm sure you could find photos of it online. And right when you walk through the gate, It's pretty silent. Nobody's really talking. And just looking around at the different things that people wrote, I didn't even actually read anything yet, but my emotion just overcame me and just started crying the whole time I was there. And pretty much everyone else was on the same page. And it was very moving. It was very, it was sad, but it was sort of like this emotional release that you were kind of sharing with everybody. It was this really interesting communal thing. It's almost as if, like, you know, like what religions try to do, you know? So the second to last night that we were there, we were watching the temple burn. And so when the Burning Man happens, when the man actually burns, everyone's partying, all the art cars are around, everyone's having a good time, drinking, getting crazy. But when the temple burns, everybody's quiet, there's no music, everyone's just watching the temple burn. And that's like everything that they wrote down for, you know, their uncle that died, or like even their pets that die, whoever. It's all gets burned together and it just goes away. And like that's sort of a way to make your peace with it. And I was talking to this guy who just walked over because my camp and I, we were just kind of hanging by the Playapus, and this guy was just sitting there just watching, and I was just talking to him. I was like, hey man, how you doing? And just kind of shooting the breeze. And I was like, so how many burns have you been to? He's like, I've been to 17 burns. I'm like, whoa. Wow. And so I was like, wow. So I was like, you know, the temple was burning and he was having his moment. But I felt compelled to ask. I said, hey man, you know, what are your thoughts about Burning Man in the past and Burning Man now? Like, is it better or worse? And he's, no, it's not better or worse. It's just evolving. It's different. And there are, and you know, he kind of touched upon like there are outside forces of, you know, the rich elite kind of coming in and having their own private area where they can view and not get dirty. And Mark Zuckerberg went there, and there's a lot of that. And he's like, but it, you know, it's just evolving, and it's just, it is what it is, and it's just going to keep on changing, and it's not better or worse.
That's fascinating. One thing that kind of that I thought was interesting in your description of also, you know, the people on the yacht and how they didn't have playa dust, right? Mm-hmm. So this kind of marked them. So in creating this liminal space, right, there are always certain things that kind of allow communities to form, you know, things that you bond over, similar with the temple. And it seems, you know, this playa dust, did you see it as kind of a marker of the people who were the real burners, or, you know, if they were, you know, walking around getting, you know, the dust on them and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at it like this. If you're in the Black Rock Desert, or Black Rock City, rather, you're going to get dusty no matter what. And I didn't really think about it until someone brought it to my attention later on. Because I saw it, I was like, whoa, that's crazy. That's a yacht in the desert right now, blinking. That's nuts. Where am I right now? And I didn't really think of it as like this crazy, you know, elite group of people just trying to walk around, you know, ride around and look at the, you know, the craziness that's going on. I didn't look at it like that. I just looked at it as everybody's here. We're all equals, and we're all bringing our own, you know, mind and experiences to the table, and hopefully we can be open with each other and try to grow.
Yeah, and thinking about this also, I think in analyzing, right, the connections between Burning Man and everyday life, what you're saying, right, about this kind of this cohesiveness of the community, right, that makes Burning Man special, I think relates a lot to how, you know, our very individualized society, we then, you know, people who go to Burning Man, they can then have the space, right, to have this cathartic collective release. And as you were saying, right, I think this is a very religious thing, because as Emil Durkheim postulated way back when, right, God is society. And, you know, so much of the religious experience is bound up in being connected to a community, you know, whether a church community, a synagogue community, a temple community. So I think it is, you know, one of the big kind of primal things in religion is it needs to be a collective experience.
Yep, exactly. And that goes back to the earliest monumental architecture that we see, the earliest places, like I said before, they all have that quality of being places where they weren't occupied year-round. They were migrations. These were places where week-long events like this were held. So maybe there's something about what it is to be a person tied up in this whole idea of what Burning Man is trying to represent as well.
Mm-hmm. I think we're really complaining about this too, is that thinking about the transformative capacity of this, right? And that's kind of like Emil Durkheim's too, can like, whether God is society in his argument, or sort of how we find, you know, emotional transformation in something, right? And so, because one of the things that sort of comes up with Burning Man too is like, is this sort of like a political thing? Is it like Occupy Wall Street, or in some ways that it's trying to reinvent society? But there's some really compelling ways to think about this, that in fact, it's actually not. And part of it is because Burning Man's not trying to reinvent how this works. And this is actually by a poster named Caveat Magister, which is, of course, obviously a pseudonym used on the Burning Man blogs I was looking through. And one of the things that this author points out is that like, this is not a political movement in the way that it's not trying to reinvent the wheel. And even like in how people participate, I mean, your political ideologies, your identities, when you're going into Burning Man are not, those things can be erased when you get there. But on top of that, like Burning Man to work depends upon taking materials from the outside, because you're going to the Black Rock Desert. There's nothing there. Isn't it a dried up lake bed, right? It's the site, you know? And so the point is not to necessarily just erase what already exists. But as you kind of point out, Ben, I think what you're saying to Anil with Durkheim is that this is about a transformation in some ways, right? It's not about throwing everything out. Part of that can be part of the experiment, I wonder, you know, but the idea is like it has, as you said, with the temple, which is really a really beautiful story. Like the idea that this is about transformation in some ways. This is, again, if you want to think about the liminal phase too, that this is where what you see is transforming. Literally the idea of consuming fire, right? That it's called Burning Man partially because, yeah, you can get a sunburn, but because you burn everything too at the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. You literally burn down what you made. So it's this really fascinating sort of implications of, you know, what are we transforming here? Like, and this is about transformation versus like making it a sustainable, as you said, final impact, right?
Yeah. So much of this seems to be about preserving a place, really, right? You bring all this stuff in, but then you have to bring it all out. It being, right, the largest leave no trace event, as you said, Ben. And that seems to be so much of it, right? We have you know, the rest of society, the rest of our lives throughout the year. But then you have this one place, right, this Burning Man space they can go to for a week. And I was wondering, Ben, also, so you talked about how, you know, one of the great things about the event was that you could have these really deep conversations with strangers who, you know, you felt a bond with at that site. Are there any relationships that you made at Burning Man that have continued in kind of the afterburn, or what has been the impact in kind of your social webs?
Well, the people within my camp, I certainly made some really strong connections there. Most of the time I was just frolicking off, you know, just by myself. There was so much to see and so much to do that, you know, you just, every minute is something new. And one of the things that I kind of fell victim to in the beginning, but I eventually realized, was that don't stay anywhere too long, kind of keep on moving. Mm-hmm. I made some valuable connections with people, you know, and then we just left and didn't see each other again. And that was it. And I remember it, and I'm sure they'll remember it. And I never caught their last name, and they didn't get mine. And it was just, that's what the beauty of it was. You shared this moment with a complete stranger, and you know it's going to be gone forever. But the people I camped with, because you would see them continually, you know, maybe every other day, you might, oh my God, hey, where were you? It's like, oh, I went to this dance party and then checked out this lecture, and you just kind of connect. And it's like, all right, I'm going to do this thing. You want to join me? It's like, all right, let's go do it. And you both go do it. And then something happens where both you get separated, and then it's like, all right, that's it. They're into the ether, and now I'm on my own again. And, that's the very dreamlike aspect of it. And, so as far as the deep connections I made, it was mostly with people that were in my own camp. And, I certainly made a lot of new friends, and I think I fortified the beams of my current friendships that I already have. And I think that was the most beautiful thing. And, you know, I prepared as much as I possibly could, as this, you know, this being my first burn. But I think next year, you know, because I was so wide-eyed and just new to the whole thing, I think next year I'm going to try to make a little bit more of an effort to have some sort of continual relationships from Burning Man.
Yeah, it seems almost also, though, at least for your experience this year, in a way, by continually moving, you preserve the liminal space, right? You don't get, you know, kind of solidified and cemented in one reality, right? You're able to, you know, keep it moving, and this preserves the magical feeling, yeah. Right? And this kind of this lithness that you have wandering around the camp.
Mm. Totally.
Yeah, it's interesting because Seth Stevenson of the Slate article described a very similar thing. Upon leaving Burning Man, one of the friends he had met and made just such deep connections with while he was there.
I think we might be having a Brandeis call. I think we can continue.
We'll keep talking.
Okay.
I think that's the man calling.
The Burning Man's calling.
Interesting. So, as I was saying, Seth Stevenson describes this deep connection he has with this individual, and they leave it off that he's going to Africa to chase a girl, and that's the last time they'll probably ever see each other. Like you said, these connections are ephemeral. They're maybe not going to last, but they mean something deep, and that depth of what you experience lasts.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing they can be deep, but they can also be just as simple as, wow, check out that Arkar blowing fire up in the air. Isn't that amazing? And then they're going, hell yeah, it is. Cheers. And then that's it. It could just be as simple as that. You know, there was a guy that walked up to me and was like, hey, man, have a drink of this. I said, what is it? He's like, it's booze. So I drank it. And it was just like in this drinking horn. He seemed like a cool guy. I gave him a high five, and that was it. You know,
that's all.
Small little blips of pleasure, you know, were there. So it wasn't everything wasn't always super deep. It was just something as simple as that. You know, there was a camp that had it was a roller skating rink, and what was great about it was that we're getting a phone call from God, I think, here.
Yeah, one thing also in thinking about how you could possibly preserve relationships from Burning Man over the course of the year, you know, Sarah Pike in Earthly Bodies and Magical Selves, an anthropologist at Chico State University out in California, she does a lot of studies of kind of neo-pagan festivals and also Burning Man. And one thing that she found is actually the power of message boards online, right, and kind of allowing people to continue that community. Mm-hmm. But they found at Burning Man through messaging each other throughout the year and then getting ready for the next coming together.
Yeah.
Right. So have you interacted at all on the Burning Man message boards?
I haven't really. I've definitely gone on. I haven't really interacted, but I've definitely used them as a resource. Obviously, what my friends tell me is, I hold as an important source of information for the burn. But yeah, message boards just to get other random people's point of view and their experiences and stuff. And one of them was like, "Oh, there are undercover cops everywhere there," and and there were these people called the Black Rock Rangers, and they're not police officers, but they have a getup as if they're like in some kind of uniform, but they're not there to bust you. They're there just to just to meet with you, talk with you, make sure you have enough water, and like, hey, where's your camp? You know where you're going? Is everything cool? You know,
just
your friends
here. Make
sure
you're safe.
Yeah, and just like talking to people, like they're sort of just making sure you're safe. That's really what it comes down to. Even if you were on a drug or something like that, they wouldn't rat you out. They would say, okay, well, let's go to a safe place. There's Center Camp, which is in the middle. It's in the center of the city, and you can go there, and it's amazing. They have a bunch of – it's like a total chill zone. And in the very center of Center Camp is where they have this circle where you can people are just doing acro yoga, and there are some people playing music, and it's just a beautiful place, and there's tons of artwork around there. And that's actually the only – you can actually buy something there, and all you can buy is coffee. That's it. That's the only thing you buy. For $1, you can go to Center Camp, get yourself coffee. I'm sorry. What was the question again?
Oh, just reflecting on the use of message boards and the internet around the event.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people say there are sort of these safe havens, because the thing is that there's music playing 24/7, all day, all night. You cannot avoid it, ever. It's there. It's you just have to accept it. It kind of becomes you, and it's much more of what I like to call the boots and cats music. Boots and cats. So there's that constantly, which, got a little old, but then after a while, it was like, oh, yeah, this is just, it's there.
It's just the background music.
It's the background music. Yeah. And the thing that I did kind of like about it was that, that music, it doesn't really try to pretend something it's not, and it serves the purpose. It serves a simple purpose for you just to move. And at any given point during the burn, I always kind of had like a slight head bob, or it just kind of kept you going, That and coffee and like the water and people just being really excited to go check out this new thing. And it's just, that's what kept you going. And so in a way, the music did serve a purpose.
That reminds me, actually, there's a really cool book called This Is Your Brain on Music. It's The Science of the Human Obsession by neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. And, again, we'll post this on the website, but it's the same thing. I mean, the way you just described that is like, it's this sort of underlying current that if there's a good beat, you just want to bob your head, and like having it for these kind of event that like, in which you are in this sort of, for lack of a better term, different social environment, right? In which there's a lot of newness. There's that constant, right, that your brain can latch into. And it's really kind of a cool I'm glad you described that, because it made me kind of jump to this book and think about it. Hate to say, I think we're out of time for the show for today, but I think there's so much stuff we haven't even touched on. We're going to do a TAL first, This Anthro Life first, and we're going to continue the conversation later today. And so we're going to have an extended edition of this episode with Benji. We'll put it up online later this week. A good 2-3 hour conversation. It'll be one of our longest episodes. We're really excited about it. We sort of made this call as we're talking right now. And so, again, I want to say thank you so much, Ben, for joining us today. It's been a really cool interview.
Oh, thank you guys so much. I love all three of you. And thanks again for having me on this podcast. And it's been a pleasure. I can't wait to share my photos later on. You can put up a link. That'd be perfect. Like
absolutely. We'd love to. Yeah.
Thanks so much, guys. It's been great.
Cool, yeah. Well, thank you again, Ben, for joining us, listeners. So this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. This is Adam Gamwell.
This is Anil Tripathi.
And this is Ryan Collins.
All right, we'll see you guys next week.
Have a good one.